listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we're having a continuing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone, and we're going to be talking about, as we began doing in the past 2 weeks, the end days of the Soviet Union, which seem particularly apropos right now, as it seems like we may be living through the end days of the U.S. and that whole construct as well. It looks like it's imploding on itself. Watching those hearings, looking at this whole thing with the leaks from the White House, supposedly, and Woodward, and the New York Times anonymous source editorials, and all this craziness. But we're going to first deal with and see if we can learn from the history of the end days of the Soviet Union. Maybe that will arm us for what's coming here.
Thank you. Thank you, Don. Yes, we're talking about the year 1991. We started talking 2 weeks ago, as Don said. And it's the key year, because by December 31st, 1991, there was no longer a Soviet Union. And of course, as we know, Putin called it the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century, which is misinterpreted. I think he qualified it. Do you know in what sense he meant it?
Well, first of all, I agree with the statement.
Yeah, I agree with the statement too.
Because,
but I wonder if there's more to it. If he qualified it.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the four corners of it.
Yeah,
that stuff's not reported here, and even
we agree.
Yep. But in terms of, I do agree with him on that point. And, assuming that he's doing it by measuring the reality, one major reality is we went from a multipolar world, or at least a bipolar world, a multipolar world, to a unipolar world for a period of time, emboldened with the idea, fallacious as it may have been, that it had just won some great struggle, great moral battle that gave it the authority to run the world the way it wanted. And it began almost immediately, before the collapse, as a matter of fact, as it was happening, they started to destroy Iraq, a project that's still ongoing.
Panama was bombed first thing.
Yep.
1989.
Yep.
You know, I think that that was a test bombing. You remember the bombing of Panama by
yep.
George Sr.?
Yeah, but that was over here. You know, you've got the Monroe Doctrine operating.
Oh, you're talking
about... I'm talking about
yeah,
declaring war, like, you know, in that hemisphere. And yeah. and that was done with the, you know, full cooperation of the Soviet Union at that point. It certainly was not thwarted at all by the Soviet Union.
Well,
and
no, by 1989. But that's what I mean
right.
by... At that time, there were commentaries saying, aha, this is testing.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, and that most likely is true.
Yeah. Okay, so, yeah, you're right. Not to mention, you know, the dissolution of the Soviet Union were 100 languages and identities and et cetera. Okay, but we start, because it's not talked about much, with the August coup, we continue... what we started last week. So just to summarize, the August coup is called coup in Western accounts.
Right.
In reality, it might have been the last stand of resistance by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and these were big guns. So... But we'll call it a coup for now.
That's what people call
maybe,
it here. You're right.
No,
but it wasn't. Maybe. As a matter of fact, the coup was already underway, and these were people that represented, you know, the existing order, in whatever condition it was in. And
yeah,
they were fighting a coup.
As I will mention, I mean, this is why it's turning, calling it a coup when the coup, the real coup, had been going on since late 1980s and
right.
earlier by the Gorbachev moves in contact with Western interests and Western United States. So
right.
so to call the August coup, which the August event a coup, that's not, it's driving me crazy. Let's see if it becomes clear once I explain it. So we'll call it a coup, the August coup for now, and I expect the later history, if it is socialist, will rename it as what we think, or suspect it was, a heroic act of last resistance by members of the CPSU and the KGB to save the USSR. So another thing that we have to be careful about is that there are questions about this coup. And so maybe future history will also determine if this coup was genuine or manufactured to speed
right.
up the process of disintegration
right.
of the Soviet Union.
Right, because whatever it was failed. So was it designed
it
to
and
was
the
it designed to fail?
The
right, because it provoked a response, a public relations opportunity, and
yep.
essentially all of it, you know, can be looked at as a whole narrative and perhaps as a whole design.
Yeah, so we have. That's right. We cannot discount. We have to be a little skeptic because of the way, because it failed.
Right.
But accounts. So I just want to stay on track. Definitely.
Yeah. Let's deal more with the details instead of interpreting it. So, and we can come back to it. Go ahead.
Yeah. So in 1990. The chairman of the 1990 December, the chairman of the KGB, Khrushchev?
Yes.
Put together, not in hiding or anything, put together a plan in case a state of emergency should occur and what to do. And he involved the ministers, etc.
Right.
Now, so let's just say that what is called the coup originated as a plan to meet an emergency situation.
Right. And that was, okay, there was a plan that was being discussed between Khrushchev, who was the head of the Soviet KGB, and Yazov,
and he invited, who was the yeah, ministers, yeah,
from the, and the military. And what we found, what you found, is that George Bush, the president of the U.S. back then, his NSA was monitoring the communications between the head of Soviet KGB and the military command from December 1990 all the way up to the actual coup in 1991 specifically. So they were in the communications loop, NSA.
Yes, and just let me find, the interference of the NSA. It was, right.
Yep.
So, George Herbert W. Bush worked with the NSA, monitored communication between Khrushchev and Dmitry Yazov, who was the defense minister, and the communication between these two and the military command posts throughout the Soviet Union were being monitored. And and I don't know whose point of view is this, but signal intelligence show a limited military support of the coup.
Right.
This is Spanish or Italian Wikipedia, okay? So
right,
I have to. Apparently, according to these communications, most of the commanders refused to even receive calls from Moscow. But we have to consider that this might be the Washington narrative anyway. But there's no doubt that Bush made the unprecedented decision to deliver intelligence information to Boris Yeltsin on the coup,
right,
on what was being planned. And also attached to Yeltsin, a communications expert from the United States Embassy in Moscow, assigned to be a minder, Yeltsin's assistant, to secure telephone calls to military leaders. So the U.S. Embassy was facilitating the communication by the president of Russia or whatever he was,
He was president of the Russian Federation, yeah.
Yeah, facilitated communication between president of Russia and his military leaders.
Right.
Finally, the NSA actually opposed Bush's decision to share signal intelligence with Yeltsin because they said, this will compromise the future ability to monitor Russian military communications, so he can't have that.
Right.
But that says a lot, about how much Yeltsin was in dependent on the United States for guidance in this situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, there's another aspect to this, too. The military chain of command at this time, this is before December 25th, 1991.
Right.
The military chain of command runs from the military to the Soviet government, not to the Russian Federation government, which was, basically just one member state in the Soviet Union. And so Yeltsin's not in that chain of command at this point. They owe their loyalty to the president of the Soviet Union and to the Soviet government. And so which Yeltsin was not really part of. He was part of the government of one of the constituent republics of the Soviet Union.
Yeah,
which is
he
different.
Was a governor, as
exactly,
you put it,
like a governor of Pennsylvania or something.
Right.
So the Joint Chiefs of Staff don't consult with the governor of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's right. And this is what the NSA was doing. But so, what else on the coup? Well, so we have more questions than answer on this.
Well, the interesting part is, no matter which was the cart or horse here, meddling, definitely figures in this. Did Russia do anything resembling any of this in 2016?
Of these crazy maneuvers?
Right. You know, with the...
No.
Exactly.
I mean, pure words, Americana.
Right.
You know, intrigues and...
Right.
No. Okay, so now this attempted coup in the Soviet Union was a three-day period between August 19 and 21 in 1991, in which a group of members of the government and the KGB, as I said, of the Soviet Union, tried to retake control of the country. And again, it's a matter of who tells the story. Some say they tried to retake control of the country. Others say that they went against democratic reforms, that they were the hardliners.
Right.
So, but I can't occupy two seats, and so I'm going to try to simplify.
Right.
Now, the leaders of the coup were members of the Communist Party, yes, but they were also ministers of the Soviet Union.
Right.
And they did think that Gorbachev's reform program had gone too far. And what apparently triggered the coup was on the 17th, these leaders read the new Treaty of the Union
right.
that Gorbachev had put together and was to be signed on the 20th, I think.
Right.
And they concluded that he had negotiated that this treaty dispersed the power of the central government in favor of the Soviet republics. Of course,
right.
it was in favor of the Russian Republic to be able
right.
to break away. But...
Let me give people a little context for this. At the time that this was happening, there had been excited in a number of the constituent republics of the Soviet Union, in other words, some of the states, some of the other countries besides Russia, the Baltics, for example, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Ukraine. Georgia.
Lithuania was the first in 1989.
Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. There was the unrest that was being stirred up. Now, you had the economic conditions had been created that would promote unrest in the first place. And that was ongoing from pretty much from the time that Gorbachev took office. And while that unrest was being manifest, it was being organized in a secessionist mode almost, in an anti-Russian mode, certainly. And so what was being raised was a demand by some dissidents, which were getting huge coverage in the West, out of proportion to their actual popularity at home, but huge coverage. And there's a feedback loop from that they should secede from the Soviet Union. And so there was a condition and a political condition as well, where you had people who were in these local governments, you know, the regional, the republic governments, could see an enhancement of their own power if they could have some of the functions taken from the central government to the local government, like you see going on here from time to time when they argue over the states' rights and pushing funding down to the state level from the federal government and et cetera. So while all that soup was being made, Gorbachev decides that it's time to renegotiate the arrangement and push some of these things out to the republics, you know, some power down to the republics, and he's got Yeltsin demanding that as the head of the Russian Republic, and a constituency inside the republic government for that, and he's got, in addition to all of that, this rear guard movement that's starting to develop, and so he thinks that, and he's, again, watching the Western media as well. Perhaps the situation is like a runaway train, and if we renegotiate the union and make some concessions to the regional governments, then we can hold this together. And in any event, that's how he tries to sell it. And
that's
so what
right.
happens is, as he puts together this thing that, in essence,
reconstructs
the Soviet Union, and by the way, changes it. The basis of the Soviet Union is in the terminology. Okay, although there is a formal government structure that looks conventional like what other European governments did, it was actually a union of Soviets The Communist Party was integrated into this. And what they were doing was they were going to change the foundational relationships inside the society and create, in essence, a European state or a set of European states that would look more like the EU looks now than the Soviet Union. And that is what provoked opposition.
The most important leaders were, interestingly, Boris Pugov in the Interior Minister, who was the Interior Minister, and he and his wife committed suicide on the 23rd, I think, of August, he and his wife, but the rumor is that they were murdered, and the Interior Minister, of course, is key, is a key ministry, and I don't know how to interpret that, but he did commit suicide. Dmitry Yazov was the defense minister, so in charge of the military, and he was a marshal, the last marshal of the Soviet Union. And then there was the leader of leaders, which was Vladimir Kryuchkov, who died in 2007, and he was the chairman of the KGB and author of the plan we talked about way back in December 1990, which was monitored by the NSA, talking about meddling. Okay, so they failed. Maybe it was too little, too late. Two tank divisions of what is called the Red Army were supposed to act and did move to encircle Moscow, but on the 21st they didn't act. The counter-revolutionaries, that is, the anti-coupsters, say that the leaders were supposed to have ordered 250,000 handcuffs and prepared 300,000 detention orders. But I wouldn't blame them if they had, because it was, you know, a revolutionary, anti-revolutionary condition. At any rate, that's just gossip.
Right.
So the question is, who benefited? Well, unfortunately, it was the reformists, the counter-revolutionary. This is what happened in several points, about 10 points. The events of this coup undermined the legitimacy of the CPSU because they failed, contributed to the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Right.
So the Treaty of the Union, however, was scrapped, was not signed.
Right.
The Treaty of the Union of Sovereign States.
Right.
So, sovereign states, that was not signed. It was suspended. It will come back under another name in December.
The CIS, right.
Three, the republics opposed to the coup were Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Moldavia.
Right.
Or Moldova now. The international forces opposed to the coup were the United States, the EU Parliament, primarily. The Supreme Soviet of Russia, of the RSSF Russia,
Russian Soviet Federated, RSFSR, Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic.
Okay. I don't know why they had the F there.
No,
anyway.
No, it's because it depends on what language. In English, it's Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic. But in Russian, for example, it's it would be whatever, Russia, Sovietsky, Socialist Federacy, whatever, Respublika. So there'll be different letters depending on what language. I assume Italian is different also.
Yeah. So the Supreme Soviet of Russia, let's call it, replaces the Soviet flag with the historic Russian flag, that is the tricolor. Now, these are all minor things. This civil society that you talked about produced the kind of spectacle that plays in the West. Oh, a statue is symbolically, you know, like the statue of Saddam. Well, the statue of Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Cheka, was demolished. We stood in front of the KGB building in Dzerzhinsky Square, the Lubyanka. Okay, these are minor. But starting on August 24, you got a Rolling Stone effect here. Gorbachev resigned from the position of Secretary General of the Communist Party Soviet Union. On August 24th, Yeltsin transferred the archives of the Communist Party Soviet Union to the authorities of the State Archive. So he removed the files.
And you know, okay, go ahead, because this is processing.
No, please, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, no, it's okay, because say the next one also.
Okay, on August 25th, look how rapid these things happen. Yeltsin nationalized the properties of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which went over people's property in Russia, including not only party offices and building, etc., but also educational institutions, hotels, etc. That's August 25th. On November, I skip to November 30, but I go back to
August. Let's stay on August 25th. What happened here on the 24th? Yeltsin transferred the archives, quote-unquote, of the CPSU to the authorities of the State Archive. That means it nationalized the archives of the CPSU, and then the following day nationalized the rest of the properties. And so what you have essentially here, you have to think about this in the context of, again, what the Soviet Union actually was. What you have is the nationalizing by, in other words, the state taking over the Communist Party and its property. In other words, what you have,
Soviet Union.
Yes, and on behalf of Russia, there's that aspect too. But here's the part I want to get to. Look at the class character of this.
Mm-hmm.
The Communist Party is the leading authority because it's the Workers' Party. Okay, the workers are the state is one with the Workers' Party, and what's happening here is that what is about to be exposed as a multi-class state. You've had the development of a bourgeoisie, even, but a petty bourgeoisie certainly over the decade from the late 70s, early 80s forward, with all kinds of black market activity, a whole lot of stuff that was going on, all kinds of money being pumped into the country from outside, you know, Western currency and such, and so. What you ended up having happen is the development of classes inside there, and what you have now is a multi-class state, and that state takes over the Workers' Party, the opposite. In other words, it undoes the revolution.
Yes, yes. Yes, it's, I'm telling you, it's mind-boggling. It's a counter-revolution, full swing. It's a taking away power from the workers and peasants, the state.
Yep.
And then skipping to November 30, Yeltsin ended the activity of the CPSU in Russia.
They just shut it down, right?
Okay, so that's November. But on August 24th, Gorbachev created the Committee for the Operational Administration of the Soviet Union. Well, what does that mean? Didn't they have a body that managed the economy?
Yeah, of the Soviet economy, not of the Committee for the Operational Administration of the Soviet Economy. Yeah, well, before you had worker and peasant ownership of the government through the Communist Party's management of the country through the government, and the government management of the economy. So consequently, you had through various agencies. The worker and peasant management and ownership of the economy. And what was happening was these things were being turned on their head, and we're only a year away from when they start parceling out ownership.
Yep. It's going. So don't tell me when Gorbachev says, you know, I was trying to save the Soviet Union and blah, 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 which we'll get to. But then again, on August 24, an important thing happens. The Supreme Rada of Ukraine approves the Declaration of Independence of Ukraine and convenes a referendum in support of the Declaration of Independence, which will happen on December 1st, which will trigger the Belavezha agreement. I mean, that would be the coup de grace. Okay. Several republics follow the example of the Ukraine. From 24 August to 27 October, the following country announced the exit from the Soviet Union. Ukraine, Moldova, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan. The one who delays the exit the most was Belarusia, which happened on the 8th of December, the very day when the Belavezha agreement will be signed. And so the latest, the two who leave the Soviet Union, the latest was Belarus and Kazakhstan. Now, the only republics that remain in the Soviet Union at the time of the December 8th agreement that will be signed for the dissolution of the Soviet Union were Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan.
I want to take 1 second and insert something here, because in September of 1991, a very important event takes place, and we're gonna end up dropping it after I point this thing out. But this, one of the things that happens in September of 1991 is that the Ministry of Fuel and Energy of the Soviet Union was converted into a joint stock company known as Rosneftgaz. It was privatized. This ends up being the place where people like Khodorkovsky make billions of dollars, and it's the formation of the Russian oligarchy. And these are some of the people that Putin very slowly put back in their cages. And this is something I guess we can maybe pick it up or skirt past that and pick up the rest of the presentation you put together next week. Luciana, thank you so much. This is, to me, so interesting. And really, again, while I'm watching the deconstruction of the world around us occur here, it's interesting to be able to study another example of it.
Yes, there is a certain amount of anarchy, I would say, yes.
Yeah, and also, you got to remember, the people that designed the deconstruction of the Soviet Union are the ones that are working on against the administration here. So it's just some of their, you know, their craft at work also in front of us. Okay, thanks. Absolutely. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. Enlisting in the military, this woman never thought she'd be in danger from her fellow soldiers. Raped, assaulted, and harassed, she was forced into a struggle that ended her career. Do victims of rape have a fair chance of justice in the U.S. military? Air Force veteran and military rape crisis center worker Jennifer Norris is with me today to share the story of her battle.
American women are reaching the highest ranks in the modern-day military, but away from the front lines, they find themselves defenseless against a threat much closer to home. Why is sexual assault so rampant in the U.S. military? What happens to victims who dare to speak out? And is the Pentagon willing to contain the epidemic its own soldiers face?
Jennifer Norris, retired U.S. Air Force veteran, activist in the Military Rape Center, who herself had firsthand experience of sexual assault in the military. Thank you for joining us in this program. I want to start right away. Now, the first time this happened, you were drugged by your recruiter. Did he trick you into having sex with him? Do you have any recollection of how the incident happened?
When I look back on the incident, I realize that I was actually tricked by this man to even go to the party to begin with. He had told me that it was a new recruit party for other recruits, and I was excited to go meet them because they would understand exactly how I felt. So he had ill intentions from the get-go, because when I got there, there were no new recruits. I was the only one.
How many times were you subjected to sexual assault or abuse? Was it just that one case?
It started with that one case, and I thought that maybe it would be over after that, that I was just unlucky at the wrong place at the wrong time, so I pushed forward. But unfortunately, as I entered into the military service, it happened again and again and again within the first 2 years of service.
So tell me this, why didn't you report straight away after that happened the first time?
I didn't report the first time because I hadn't even gone to basic training yet, and I didn't really know what to say to, I didn't even know where to go, if I was supposed to go to a commander in the military, if I was supposed to go to the police department. I was completely clueless as to what sexual assault and rape and harassment were at that time. So I just tried to soldier on and move forward with the career that I was looking forward to doing for at least 20 years.
So what happens at that moment when, you know, you're assaulted sexually? What do you feel? What do you go through? Is it guilt? Is it shame? Is it what? Uncertainty?
It used to be shame because I used to feel like I was an idiot for going to this person's party. But after years of counseling and working with rape victim advocates, I learned that predators operate in much the same way. They're very manipulative, and they will set you up for an attack, or they will take advantage of an opportunity. And so now I realize it was a calculated crime, but it took me years to realize that.
So for those who hasn't been faced with this kind of ordeal, but, you know, danger is always there, tell us, how do these manipulators actually trick their victims into it? How do they lure you in?
I think they do what you would call grooming. So they make you believe that they're trustworthy and that they're going to take care of you. And it almost seems like it's too good to be true. And so when you're naive, you don't necessarily realize that not everybody is speaking at face value. So as an 18-year-old or even a 24-year-old, it's easy to fall prey to the niceties because you don't know that there's evil lurking behind it. And I think that's the real danger of these kind of people and how they operate, is that they're able to get to us based on a trust that has been established. And in the military, we are dependent on each other in every way, especially in trust.
So how old were you, like 18, when that happened?
No, I was actually 24. I had already graduated from college as a social worker. I worked in the field for a couple years. I worked with, as a case manager, I worked on a suicide crisis hotline, and then I decided I wanted to get my master's degree, and the military offered a GI Bill that could help me accomplish those goals. So that's the number one reason that I joined, aside from being patriotic and wanting to give back and being involved in something that was bigger than myself.
Okay, so
I was completely clueless as to what was in store.
Okay. You know, one woman who went through a similar ordeal, Air Force Sergeant Marty Ribeiro, she said that the military has a way of making females believe they brought this upon themselves. Did you feel that as well?
Yes.
Did you blame yourself for what happened?
I did for the longest time, because especially with the recruiter's incident, it's as if I knew that as soon as I walked through that door that there was danger. But it was too late to turn back, and that particular incident taught me a lot about how to take care of myself in the future. Unfortunately, if you're working for someone that's assaulting you, you can't escape them. So no, I don't have shame or blame or any of that stuff anymore as far as what I did. All I did was go to work in uniform, and these people took advantage of their power and opportunity. And that's what we're trying to change, is that it's taken more seriously if someone does in fact abuse their power in that kind of a setting.
But I'm trying to figure out the psychological aspect of it. How exactly does the whole military structure make you feel guilty for what has happened and not the other way around?
I understand. So given the way that you report currently in the military, you don't go to a police officer to report a crime. You're supposed to report it to your commander. In my particular case, and in a lot of soldiers' cases, that the commander is also has a relationship with the perpetrator. And he may or may not have known the perpetrator way longer than he knows you. And so what it does is it creates an atmosphere of intimidation that if you see your commander hanging out with the same guy who assaulted you, then you feel like, oh, wow, he's not going to take me seriously. That looks like they're both really good friends. And then when you do go ahead and report, the first thing that the defense attorneys start looking into is whether or not you're this, you're that, you know, how do you conduct yourself? Are you, you know, they immediately go into, well, you shouldn't have been at this place, and if you hadn't, you know, that wouldn't happen. Well, they could have done that to me too, but it's not our fault that, you know, we thought we were attending what was supposed to be.
But I'm thinking, Jennifer, I'm thinking there are also other women working in the military. I mean, they, you know, they're compassionate creatures. You could have shared your story with them. They certainly would have understood what you went through, especially if this happens all the time. Maybe there are other women alongside you who are actually subjected to the same sexual assaults. Did you share your story with any of your female peers?
Well, what I learned is that, first of all, I was one of very few women in my squadron. There may have been, if we were lucky, three of them. And one of them is in administration or personnel, and then maybe there's another one in another shop. But I was the only female that was working for satellite communications and in combat communications. So no, I didn't have other females that I could turn to and say, you know, hey, this happened to me. As a matter of fact, I didn't want anyone to know that this had happened to me because I didn't want to be judged. Unfortunately, it appears that once people learn that you've reported a sexual assault or may have been involved in an incident, that they become scared of you instead of being scared of the perpetrator. They think that you're going to be hypersensitive to if they swear or if they say something offensive, when in fact it's not going to be that way at all. So there's a culture of fear built up in the military, and I think that's why they want to automatically blame it on the woman, because if she goes away, the problem goes away, and they can get back to work as normal.
Human Rights Watch reports a very dire picture of what happens to the victims of sexual assault. And they say, I quote, that these people are being spat on, deprived of food, assailed with obscenities, threatened with friendly fire during deployment, discharged for misconduct. Is it true? Is it really that dangerous to come forward?
It is. In some cases, it just depends on your situation. If you're isolated, you're in way more danger than, say, other people would be on some big base that has security forces in a JAG office. But if you're in some place like the Azores or, you know, in some other random location across the world and all you have is the people that are with you, then yes, you could be in grave danger if in fact someone harms you and threatens you and says that if you say anything that they will kill you. It happens. I research it. We have had non-combat deaths occur overseas that include homicide and unsolved cases that nobody is talking about. And that's what we're trying to tell people is...
Did you get threats? Were you threatened?
Yes. Not only was I threatened, but I was physically beat after I reported by one of the perpetrator's friends. The entire squadron turned on me. I was automatically the liar, even though they didn't know the circumstances, and even though we did have proof and we were able to move forward with two of the four cases. The other people in the squadron did not know what had happened, so they believed the perpetrator, who was able to tell them the story while I was at some other squadron waiting for the case to go through.
But see, for me, it's just mind-boggling that you're saying you'd be just like standing there harassed, assaulted in the open with other people just standing by and not interfering. How come no one interfered? Why didn't troops come forward for a fellow soldier?
Well, I did have a couple people that had my back along the way, but it felt more like it was a culture of fear, like nobody dared stand up to those that were higher ranking if they were the ones that were doing the harm, because they were afraid that it would have backlash on their career. To me now, I don't have respect for those people that didn't stand by and take a stand and support the ones that were actually being harmed. But along the way, there were some silent people that came up to me and said that this person had done that to them, that this person had done this to them. And so people opened up along the way, but they wouldn't take it as far as I did and actually report. Although I must say it was because of a senior master sergeant that I finally confided in. He's the one that finally convinced me to report the four individuals to the commander.
Jennifer, we're going to take a short break right now, and when we're back, we'll continue talking with Jennifer Norris, U.S. Air Force veteran, talking about the epidemic of rape in the U.S. military and what happens to those who dare to speak out against it. Stay with us.
Listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Jennifer Norris, Air Force veteran and military rape survivor, sharing the story of her ordeal and how she found the strength to move on. Now, Jennifer, Iraq veteran Chantal Henneberry says she was less scared of enemy fire than the men she served with. She recalls she would, like, drink less water to avoid going to the bathroom at nighttime because she was so terrified of being harassed. So, why do women even join the army despite hearing all these horrific stories?
I think that it boils down to people don't think that it's going to happen to them, and that's typical of, I think, just society. You just don't think that bad things are going to happen to you. I had the same mentality before I joined too. So, you know, they want to follow their dreams and they want to do what they want to do. And some of us, our dreams was to be in the military and retire and do great things and move women forward. So I think that's normal. That's okay.
United Nations is speaking out about this, the problem of sexual assault in the U.S. military. And it's saying that it needs to ensure effective prosecution of offenders. Is this going to make any difference?
Absolutely. Right now, the prosecution rate for sexual assault is less than 10% compared to the civilian world, which is at least 40%. That's what we're trying to say, is that if people are raped or assaulted and then report, we would like for these cases to be taken seriously. Right now, like I spoke to you earlier, you have to report the crime to your commander. They are not a legal professional. They are not special victims units. They do not understand how these things work. And what we want is to be able to report to a police department or a law enforcement professional, someone that understands how these people work and can't be manipulated by them.
So for years, activists and lawmakers in the United States have tried to change this protocol, right? But leaders in the military are against bringing civilians into bases to investigate alleged assaults. Why are they against it? And what are they winning this debate? Why do you think the military is winning this debate?
Because they're able to protect their institution if they're able to keep everything in-house, and that's exactly what they do. They want to stomp it out before it gets out to the public, whereas we want it out in the public so people know who these offenders are and can be on alert. They don't just offend people in the military. They're offending people in our communities as well, their wives, their children. So it's not just a military issue, it's a societal issue, and I think it would be way more effective if everyone reported to a police department where all the crime data was kept in one place.
So you're thinking completely removing sexual assault cases from the military chain of command, that would actually solve the problem?
I think standardizing the justice process in general to have it in sync with the civilian society, meaning databases connected. And, you know, whether it's the civilians that try the perpetrator or it's the military that tries the perpetrator, everyone should be talking so that we can connect the dots on who's doing what where, because it makes it a little bit more complicated with a military personnel who can transfer all over the country and to different parts of the world. We need all the data collection to be put into a system so we can actually track what these people have done through the course of time and be able to move forward with cases that may win, as opposed to a he said, she said incident.
So, Jennifer, what I'm thinking is that maybe there should be more women in the U.S. military, you know, in high-ranking positions. That way they would take up more positions and maybe kick some butt, especially regarding the men who are potential assaulters. What do you think? Should there be more women in the U.S. military?
That'd be ideal, although we have to take into account that over half of the victims in the military, actually 53% of them, are males. So this isn't a female issue necessarily. We are at higher risk because we're seen as the weaker sex, but predators do not discriminate. They are harming both men and women in the military. And a lot of media, I have been trying to cover the issue, we just have not been able to get any footing with it, but people need to know that more than half the victims are men in the military.
Here's another crazy number. According to the Human Rights Watch, only 5% of sexual assault cases in the U.S. military lead to convictions of the perpetrators. What happened to the man who assaulted you? Was he punished?
Yes. The recruiter skipped town after I threatened to report him to the commander, unfortunately, so we couldn't do anything with that case. The technical instructor that assaulted me at Keesler, Mississippi, we had no jurisdiction over because he was active duty and I was considered National Guard. And then the other two, who were both National Guard members that worked with me, we were able to move forward with cases. But by the time it went up the chain of command, it got minimized from sexual assault to sexual harassment. They both retired with full benefits after 20 years of service.
Yeah. Pentagon keeps saying that programs are implemented, changes are being made, the problem is being solved. Is it all a lie?
I don't think it's all a lie, but I definitely think that they sway the media to see things a certain way. So, for example, although the numbers may have gone down from 26,000 to roughly 19,000 the last couple of years, and they're bragging about a 30% increase in reporting, it means nothing. And the civilian world doesn't understand that in the military you can report a crime under two different guises, either restricted or unrestricted. If it's restricted, that means nobody's supposed to know about it, including your commander, so you can go forward and get some help. If it's unrestricted, then it turns into a full-blown investigation if, in fact, your commander agrees to move forward with a case, which is another sticking point. So people need to realize that although the reporting has gone up, it's been restricted reporting, which is not helping us catch these criminals. They're still not being reported. You might be able to get help, but they're still moving along in their careers, assaulting other people, while the latest victim is just getting help.
You now work with those who went through the same problem as you did. Are you seeing more cases of women speaking out? Has the situation gotten any better?
I think awareness has definitely got better around the issue, and there's way more talk about within the military and outside in the veteran community to address getting help for after someone's been traumatized by an incident like this. So that, in fact, has improved. I've actually benefited greatly from the programs that have come as a result of our advocacy with military sexual assault. So for that, I'm thankful. As far as the military justice system goes and policy goes, it's the same thing it's always been. Nothing has changed whatsoever as far as the core issues that we're trying to address, which is taking a commander out of the decision-making process as far as whether or not you're going to move forward with a case. We just want law enforcement professionals and detectives and investigators to deal with these cases, not a commander who's, you know, great at war, but has absolutely no idea how the legal process works and what sexual assault is.
What do you do for the victims? How
I shouldn't
are you
have to report
them?
To my boss. What I do is I empower them. When I did work for as an advocate, I actually would help them kind of deal with their cases as they were moving along in the process. And I noticed the same patterns over and over and over. So now what I do, because that was really hard to take until we can change things, is focus on helping them to heal despite not being able to get justice. So trying to find a place of you know, faith, and finding a place of comfort in yourself to know that you didn't do anything wrong. It's just that the system is not working well and it needs to be changed. And there's nothing we can do about it right now except to take care of ourselves and hope for the best in the future.
So you just mentioned earlier that it's not just a man-woman problem, that 51% of the ones who are being assaulted are men. And I read this recent survey also by American Psychological Association that says that number of men facing sexual assault in the military is 15 times higher than reported by the Pentagon. Now, that would mean up to 210,000 men are assaulted in 1 year. Is that number correct? Is it the right calculation?
Okay,
do you help men as
no.
well?
Yeah, oh, yes. Whoever needs help and they come to me, I will assist them as best I can. That study from American Psychological Association was retracted. They had used not a very good way to determine those numbers. It wasn't correct, so it was retracted. It's not actually that high.
What is
but it
the
doesn't
number?
Really matter. It's still high enough where it should be a concern. The actual number is what I shared with you. It's roughly 53% of the victims of military sexual assault are males. This is not a female soldier issue. This is a predator issue, and that's what we're trying to tell people.
Jennifer, thank you so much for sharing this story with us. Thank you so much for empowering women who went through the same thing as you did. Thank you so much for being so brave and outspoken, and I hope that you really win. You win over Pentagon.
Thank you.
Well, we're talking to Jennifer Norris, a retired Air Force surgeon, now activist with the Military Rape Crisis Center, speaking about sexual assault in the U.S. military, and she shared the story of her ordeal and her fight for justice. That's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I'll see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.